Hi, this is Matt Geckler. Howard Tolley is a professor of political science and adjunct professor of law at the University of Cincinnati, where he directs the Teaching Human Rights Online project. His first book, Children in War, Political Socialization to International Conflict, was published toward the end of the Vietnam conflict. He has served on the USC board and recently chaired the Peacemaking Task Force at St. John's Unitarian University Church in Cincinnati, where they adopted a comprehensive peace initiative. Well, welcome, Howard.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me?
Could you speak a little louder, Howard?
Okay. Please don't hesitate to interrupt if I need to speak up. My thesis tonight is that, like other mainline U.S. churches, UUs preach peace, but occasionally approve wars that they consider just. And I would consider the humanitarian hawks, those among our number who would approve military intervention to end the genocide, as in Darfur or Rwanda, and the pacifist dove in our faith community, those individuals who would renounce violence in all situations. And so that was the question posed to us for the CSAI study action issue. And this teleseminar is to see what we have to offer others. And my suggestion would be that if we can demonstrate a method of reconciling the competing views on war and peace within our own faith community, that UUs might then provide a model for others. I'm going to start by identifying the evidence in support of my thesis that illustrates how some UUs are humanitarian hawks and others passive as doves. And then I'd like to apply the just war principles to those cases of humanitarian intervention we might support, like Rwanda, Darfur, and more recently the tragedy in Myanmar. And then finally, I'd like to explain how at St. John's we wrestled with our differences and came up with a consensus that does reconcile the two wings of our faith community. You'll find much of what I'm going to do at the outset, differentiating UU hawks and doves, in a sermon I delivered at St. John's in March 2007 that is available on the website, along with the order of service and the accompanying readings. I started by drawing from the hymnal the hawkish music, which some of you may have sung early in your religious upbringing, as I did, the music of Onward Christian Soldiers. In our hymnal, Frederick Hosmer gave in our number 114 a different set of words to that rather martial tune. Forward through the ages, in unbroken line, move the faithful spirits. Wider grows the kingdom, reign of love and light. For it we must labor, heroes for it died. In the back of the hymnal, in the readings, we have a responsive selection from Frederick Douglass, number 579, called The Limits of Tyrants, in which he advocates a slave rebellion against injustice, as there is no other way to shake off tyranny. Occasionally on social justice marches, the chant goes out, no justice, no peace. It can be variably interpreted, but for some, including Thomas Jefferson, who we claim as our own, that may entail violence. Jefferson, as you may know, wrote that every 20 years, the tree of liberty should be watered with the blood of patriots, tyrants, we can think in our history about Unitarian Universalist support for the abolitionist movement against slavery and for the kinds of militant actions by John Brown, and our members served in the Union Army. During World War II, we had as well many patriots in our midst who fought for national self-defense against the Nazis. During that term I served on the Unitarian Service Committee board, the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, ordered the bombing of Kosovo to prevent ethnic cleansing in that situation. And the president of the UUA, John Burns, made a public statement endorsing that humanitarian intervention. Our own former UUA president, Reverend Bill Schultz, who was president of Amnesty International USA, in his book Tainted Legacy, has written, "When wickedness is in fashion, sufficient to shock the conscience of humanity, military intervention may well be justified." I'm open to taking other suggestions at this point if anybody wants to unmute and offer an additional illustration of members of our denomination supporting humanitarian intervention, military self-defense, and the like. If not, I'll just conclude with one more.
Hello, is this?
Yeah. Was there someone who wanted to offer?
I'd like to ask a question, if I may.
Okay.
About 3 years ago, the United Nations, resolution.
I'm sorry, your voice is breaking up, and I can't hear the question.
I'm sorry. Is that any better?
Yeah, that's a little better.
The duty to protect. Did the UUA take a position on that question when it came to the United Nations?
I'm unfamiliar with that, but 2 years ago, General Assembly adopted a resolution in support of a no-fly zone to be enforced over Darfur. And the UUSC is part of the Save Darfur Coalition, which is an alliance of 167 faith-based groups, and they are, without necessarily calling it the responsibility to protect, they are calling for a much stronger UN peacekeeping force to stop that genocide in Darfur. And if we were to enforce a no-fly zone, recall how that worked when President Clinton enforced it over Iraq, when Saddam Hussein's Air Force was not allowed to fly over half their country. There were repeated military strikes against Iraqi planes, which were flying over their own country in the no-fly zone that we were enforcing. So it seems to me that the GA resolution supporting the no-fly zone is an endorsement by our denomination of using force for humanitarian intervention. The dovish elements, I think, which are a contrast to what I've just described, include a very good friend of mine from the Yellow Springs Unitarian Fellowship, who in World War II was a conscientious objector, and he refused to even do non-military service and spent several years in detention as a result of that. We have had numerous General Assembly resolutions over the years opposing the Vietnam War, offering our moral support for Quakers and Mennonites in their conscientious objection, supporting the UN peace efforts, opposing nuclear weapons. And the hymnal is, of course, replete with readings and music that advocate absolute nonviolence, readings by Martin Luther King and one that I used in the service by Mahatma Gandhi, number 577, "It is possible to live in peace." So we have, as I see it, a split in our midst, and one that must be addressed with sensitivity to our principle for the tolerance of diverse points of view and the search for the truth that each conducts and the democratic nature of our decision making. So part two of this introductory presentation before I open for questions is the attempt I made to settle in my own mind whether I would favor military intervention in Darfur, Sudan, to end that genocide. And my reasoning is based upon principles that date back to Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, and Augustine, the two parts of the just war test. Part one is whether or not the use of military force is justified in that particular situation. And part two is, if force is justified, what type can justly be used? How should the military conduct its campaign? And on half, three out of the six parts of the first test, it seems to me that humanitarian intervention in Darfur would be just, because it satisfies the test of just intention, that we are not motivated by national interest. We would be a predominantly white Christian state coming to the rescue of black African Sunni Muslims who are subject to extermination by Arabs. So as long as we had no hidden agenda to acquire Sudan's oil or to establish long-term military bases, it would be a just war on that criterion. It would also be justifiable if the force used was proportional and that it must not exceed a reasonable death and destruction. And certainly the balance would be the Sudanese loss of life without intervention is considerably higher than it would be with an intervention. And quite apart from Darfur, there is a legitimacy of the self-defense the United States did after the attack of September 11th by going after Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So defending another nation against an attack, and certainly defending our own nation when there's an attack on our own soil, those are all justifications. But there are other tests that I think would be much more difficult to meet in an intervention in Darfur. First of those is that a legitimate authority must approve it. And in my professional judgment, that means the UN Security Council alone has that legal authority under international law. And it's not going to approve because of the vetoes by China and Russia. You would not be able to act without having a unilateral decision by the United States that has not been authorized. Now, Bill Shultz is prepared to go that route. In Tainted Legacy, he concludes, the rule must therefore be something as ambiguous as intervention must be sanctioned by the international community except when in the case of genocide or ethnic cleansing, that community is not willing to act. There are two other grounds of the just war test that I think also would be difficult to meet for Darfur. First, there must be the exhaustion of all other diplomatic and non-military options before you resort to force. And, perhaps most difficult of all, there must be a reasonable chance of success. That civil war in Darfur now has three and possibly four sides, and we have seen the mess made in Iraq by the United States trying to bring a halt to a civil war that is beyond our chance of reasonable success. Now, even if I'm wrong on those last three parts and you feel humanitarian intervention in Darfur would still warrant support by UUs, you have to go to the second set of criteria on how that intervention would be conducted. And there must be minimal loss of non-combatant life. And we have routinely, in the course of our recent interventions, wreaked considerable collateral damage. I mean, that was certainly the case in Kosovo, where no Americans lost their lives, where our planes did high-altitude bombing so that they were out of range of gunners, and as a result, they missed targets, and a lot of noncombatants died. So it was a good end to prevent ethnic cleansing, but it was done in a way that, I would say, violates just war principles. The violence we use there must be proportionate as well, and you have a prohibition on attacking places of worship and targets. You can't use particular kinds of weapons like chemical defoliants. And we've seen the United States, even with the best of intentions, using munitions with depleted uranium that have caused considerable suffering for innocents long after the war ended. So, as you use, when we at St. John's were trying to come up with some contribution to the process of drafting a resolution for General Assembly, we have, over a four-month period, met in a series of forums, one on each of the six theme areas identified: international, environmental, societal, inner peacemaking, environmental. And I'm just going to talk about the international war debate that we had and what we came up with that was unanimously approved for the most part in a special congregational meeting on April 27th. And you can find a report of that, again, up on the St. John's UU Church website in Cincinnati. In order to accomplish a successful meeting, we separated into two parts what we presented to the congregation. The first was reduced to a single page, 10 statements that were voted upon, and the second was a two-page background paper where we elaborated on some of those implementation measures that we would continue working on, including those for which we could not reach consensus in our peacemaking task force before we went to the floor for the whole congregation. The first thing we did was added the word peace to the church mission statement, which had good language about social justice and respect for freedom of thought, but the word peace didn't appear in the mission statement, so that was added to it, and that mission statement will go into the church bylaws. We also had a 7-point covenant that was adopted by the church back in November 22, 1998, and again, the word peace didn't appear in it. So we redrafted one of those in order to add peace to justice and equity that had previously been affirmed. Then we have a strategic plan for the church that sets 5-year targets and goals, one of which was to create a unifying activity that created an identity for the church that might help it distinguish itself. Back in the 1960s, our church was known as an anti-war church during the Vietnam conflict, and the members have had a variety of social action issues, but no unifying theme. And I think the virtue of having the six elements in the peacekeeping initiative was that we said this is more than a social action project. This is, in fact, something which ought to infuse everything that we do, so that at board meetings, issues of congregational dispute resolution peacefully in a nonviolent way ought to be addressed. In book groups, there ought to be attention in the First Friday flicks that are shown, our partner church program, and then in the environmental area as well. We've been working toward Green Sanctuary, but the peace theme, I thought, helped to unify that with the other activities. What we found was, to some extent, a tension between individuals that thought one of those six themes ought to have been the top priority, and I was guilty of that at the outset by thinking when this CSI issue was announced, it really should have focused exclusively on international war. But I discovered as well that the Green Sanctuary folks thought that unless we saved planet Earth, there was nothing way we could achieve peace, so that their item had to come first. And then we have that reading in our hymnal about unless we find inner peace, there can't be peace in the family, in the neighborhood, in the community, and in the world. So we ultimately came to accommodate one another and to incorporate all of those into that grand statement that we made. But the ones of greatest interest to me still are those which entail our principles about international conflict, sectarian violence, and civil war. And so the background paper affirms that we only accept military action when it's either in self-defense or it's for humanitarian intervention. But immediately after affirming that, we go on to say, in accord with the fifth principle, affirming the right of conscience, pacifist members who reject just war may disavow any denominational or church resolutions that approve the use of force. Whether it's in self-defense or humanitarian intervention, we want to respect the rights of pacifists in our midst and not make them feel unwelcome. And we further, in educating our youth, called for training them, educating them in both pacifist and in just war principles, as well as their right to choose freely between conscientious objection and military service. And we decided that for those who elected to make a formal commitment as conscientious objectors, that we would offer some certification so that should the draft be reinstituted and individuals conscripted, they could make an argument that based on their religious principles, their faith community had recognized them as conscientious objectors. Now, that doesn't take us to the extent of the Quakers and the Mennonites, but I think it is a step forward for our faith community that, so far as I know, has not previously formally acknowledged that decision by our youth. In the debate at our congregational meeting, some who were veterans or had family members who served in the military thought we were tilting too much in that direction. And we have another piece in the discussion paper that declares our respect for those in uniform, noting that on Memorial and Veterans Day, we do pay special tribute to those who've risked their lives in national service. But yet at the same time, we declare that U.S. military personnel who are accused of war crimes, well, they're entitled to due process, but if they are granted impunity,